Thank you, Professor Shiffman, and all of the organizers for the invitation to speak. Sorry about that. I was just turning off some of the features. Today I'm going to talk about the large quantum number expansion and its relation in varying degrees of specificity to localization, conformal bootstrap, resurgence, in N equals two superconformal theories in four dimensions from the point of view of the large quantum number expansion. Many check marks there. So what is the large quantum number expansion? It may or may not be a fascinating subject in itself. I'm not going to try to... Yes, not going to try to make a case for that today, but it's turning out to be a somewhat useful tool. It's been used to see new sorts of phenomena in strongly coupled field theories, which are accessible neither to any conventional perturbation theory nor easily accessible to the numerical bootstrap. One can make that stronger or less strong, but easily is being is an understatement. Okay. So many cases have been studied so far. So the conformal large spin expansion in a single plane due to Komorgansky and Jaboydev simultaneously, Fitzpatrick, Kaplan, Poland, and Simmons-Duffin. Large spin expansion in confining theories. So by effective field theory, agreeing results by S-matrix bootstrap, and then a more refined results by S-matrix bootstrap, all confirming the effective field theoretic analysis. Large charge expansion for the O2 model, which was confirmed by Monte Carlo results to really incredible accuracy just this year. Large global charge expansion in various other vector models in three dimensions at the conformal fixed point. And then large charge expansion in superconformal field theories, which is what I'll be talking about today. So there are a few things about the large quantum number expansion that are valuable to be aware of. So the explanation for the simplifications of the large quantum number expansion kind of looks very different in different cases. So it's something where the explanation for the applicability of the expansion appears to transcend the actual existing explanations in the individual cases where it applies. So for the case of large spin in a single plane in a conformal theory, it can be explained by the analytic conformal bootstrap. For the case of large global charge, it was first understood by an effective field theory analysis of a conformal Goldstone field, generalizing the old Kalman-Wesson-Zimino analysis. And for large spin and confining theories, it was first understood through an effective field theory analysis on the string world sheet, and was later confirmed by various types of S-matrix bootstrap. So it would be better to make these modes of explanation overlap rather than being disjoint. And there has been some progress. So certain aspects of the large quantum number expansion for confining strings, as I say, have been confirmed by bootstrap. And then certain features of the large spin expansion, large spin in a single plane, can be predicted from effective gravity, effective field theory coupled to gravity near the boundary of an ADS holographic dual. I should say this is slightly off topic, but this is really fascinating because it does not require the usual hierarchy of scales that have to be present for a holographic analysis. In particular, the large spin expansion is good in the bulk, even when the Polchinski, Pentadonis, Hemskirk, Sully conditions are not satisfied. So there is a sort of improved perturbative parameter going as the inverse log of the spin. The large quantum number expansion is duality invariant. This is one interesting and important thing about it. So since the expansion doesn't rely on any sort of weak coupling parameter in the Lagrangian, but rather the inverse quantum number itself, S-duality is manifest in the expansion, in contrast to the usual perturbative expansion. So it's a sort of duality invariant perturbation theory, which numerically has been shown to be very remarkably good in all circumstances where it's been applied. And I should say that's really, in the end, the origin of this that's the origin of this bullet point, and why I think it's a good topic here. It's really for the resurgence theorists. These results will present more questions than answers. The question is really, why is the large J expansion so good, and is there a resurgent explanation for that? I believe it's better than sort of any known, Lagrangian perturbation theory away from sort of artificial recoupling limits. So S-duality is manifest in the perturbative in the large J expansion in contrast to the usual perturbation expansion. And I say manifest, but I don't mean automatic. I only mean that the duality transformation or the duality covariance can be expressed simply in terms of the large J description. So the result is that one can get a simple predictive picture of the large J behavior using certain simple inputs like duality or the existence of an effective field theory with certain properties, but we may not easily be able to prove those properties from a bootstrap point of view. And again, the word easily is sort of, I'm just trying to not make people mad. I think it seems very hard. So however, there is interesting work in progress by Jaffris, Metzenov and Zhiboydev on bootstrapping at least the leading order of the SO2 conformal Goldstone theory. But this is still work in progress. So today I'm going to talk about another case in which we can independently check the large J analysis in two different ways. So first of all, by an effective field theory analysis on the one hand, and also by exact methods using superconformal symmetry on the other hand, which can be understood as a sort of hybrid of localization and bootstrap methods. So specifically, I'll be talking about n equals 2 superconformal symmetry in four dimensions. So for n equals 2 theories, there are only two types of multiplets of massless particles that can live in such a theory: a hypermultiplet, which contains a Dirac fermion, two complex scalars, and a vector multiplet, which contains a Dirac fermion, a complex scalar, and a gauge field. We won't be saying much about anything really except the scalars. So the moduli space of supersymmetric vacua generally consists of several components, and one where the vector multiplet scalar gets a VEV, breaking the gauge group to its Cartan subgroup, is called the Coulomb branch. So sometimes there are massless neutral hypers as well, which can be referred to as an enhanced Coulomb branch, but we'll just refer to all those cases as Coulomb branches. And then for simplicity, we're only going to consider the case of rank 1, so that the Coulomb branch has a single U1 vector multiplet containing a complex scalar A. So the massless hypers, if there are any, are decoupled at the level of the leading low-energy effective action. Okay. So the mass of scalar A is a chiral field. It's annihilated by all the supergenerators, which carry positive R charge under the R symmetry. And the U1 R symmetry. And the dimension of such operators is completely determined by their spin and their R charge, and scalar operators have dimension equal to J. And this is a slightly non-standard but very, very convenient normalization of the R charge. So the scalar A generally does not correspond to an operator of the microscopic CFT, only an operator of the effective theory. So the field A has just dimension plus one. So if it were really a microscopic operator in the microscopic CFT, it would be free by virtue of the unitarity bound. So operators that saturate the unitarity bound are delta equals one are always free, scalar operators, in a conformal theory of any kind. But it's not. It's just an effective field. So the low energy action for the scalar field A is just gauge coupling, inverse gauge coupling times the gradient squared. So we're going to absorb that into a into the normalization, and we'll call the unit, the field with the unit normalized kinetic term phi. And there's something interesting about that. I don't think I'll have time to get to it, but in doing that, we're doing a redefinition that is non-holomorphic in the holomorphic inverse gauge coupling, and that has some interesting consequences. But yeah, so if there's time, I'll talk about that. Right. So tau effective is the effective inverse gauge coupling, which is 4 pi I over g effective squared plus effective theta over 2 pi. So now we're going to use this action, this effective action, to compute two-point functions of powers. Powers of an operator curly O in the microscopic CFT, where curly O is a chiral operator with dimension and R charge equal to J. Well, equal to right, delta curly O. So I'm going to use curly J to be the total R charge, and delta equals J as the single R charge of the single curly O. So first, we have to identify how curly O is represented in the effective theory. So the only possibility, so for a rank one gauge, for a rank one gauge group, there's only one possible operator in the effective theory that curly O could be, and it's just phi to the delta up to some normalization. There are no other operators in the effective theory with the right R charge and dimension. So the normalization can depend on the marginal parameters, if any. Okay, so we'd like to compute the two-point function of high powers of curly O. So that's where the sort of large quantum number analysis kicks in. We want to compute the two-point function of operators with large R charge curly J, which is n times delta. Now, normally, you might think that's a little bit weird. We don't compute two-point functions in conformal field theory. Two-point functions are just one. But that's not true in a supersymmetric theory. There's a natural definition to these operators. So because the operator product between copies of curly O is non-singular, you can define the operator of charge J by just literally multiplying n copies of the single operator. Okay, so the two-point function is actually meaningful if you've chosen the normalization of curly O in some way, and we absorb that into a normalization earlier on. Okay, so yeah, so we're going to call the log of this two-point function, we call it curly B. So it's the negative of the quantum effective action of the theory with sources. negative j log phi and negative j log phi bar with delta function support at the insertion points. Okay. So now, you don't need to do anything so fancy for the leading low-energy approximation or the leading large J approximation, because that should just be given by the free field result. We've said that the effective action at leading order is free, so you expect that curly Y sub n is just given by Wick contractions, so J factorial times some normalization to the jth power. And it is. So then the next inevitable question is, how good is this approximation? And where does the leading correction to that approximation come from? So the origin of the large J expansion is the weak coupling of the moduli space description when there's a large hierarchy of scales. So here, the infrared scale is just the inverse distance between the points. And the ultraviolet scale is the scale of the masses of the W bosons or monopoles or whatever. We're not distinguishing those two because we're letting the coupling be order one. But the UV scale is the breakdown scale of the CFT, which is a order absolute value of phi. Okay, and near the points, so halfway between the points or whatever. This number is square root of j over the distance between the points in the classical solution. And so when I say the classical solution, I mean the classical solution obtained by treating those insertions as classical sources with strength j and just finding the classical solution. So in the paper, we wrote it down. It's just some solution. So the same hierarchy suppresses the contribution of higher derivative effective terms in the action. Okay. So in a conformal effective theory, every ordinary derivative partial or supersymmetric derivative must come dressed with powers of phi or phi bar in the denominator to cancel the dimension and R charge of the set of derivatives. So every partial in a term brings a suppression of at least j to the minus 1 half, because a partial has to be dressed with inverse phi, and d and d bar have to be dressed with at least j to the minus 1 quarter, because those have to be dressed with inverse square roots of phi or phi bar. Okay. So every derivative has a cost in j scaling, so at a given accuracy in the large j expansion, only a finite number of terms in the effective theory can ever contribute. So that's what makes this whole setup calculable. So the higher derivative superconformal terms have to some extent been studied, but you know they get sort of complicated very quickly. So all I'm going to say about them is that the leading contribution from a superconformal effective term is no larger than 1 over j on flat space, and then curvature corrections can actually enhance the j scaling, but no more than j to the 0 on the sphere. So to avoid having to know anything at all about the higher derivative terms, we compute only up to errors of order j to the 0 in the free energy curly B sub n. So we're not, in other words, we're not even going to try to recover the j to the 0 term. Well, perhaps we'll try someday, because I think it's quite an interesting term. But certainly, we didn't in our recent paper. Which I can't remember if I remember to mention it. It was done in collaboration with my student, Oshinska Maeda. So despite the absence of superconformal terms, there is still one term we are forced to include, which is not superconformal, and it has not an adjustable coefficient, but a prescribed coefficient. It is the Wess-Zimino term, the anomaly term, proportional to the difference between the Weyl anomaly A coefficient of the underlying CFT and the A coefficient of the effective field theory on moduli space. So now, when you try to evaluate the Wessimino term naively in the flat space conformal frame, it's a little bit unfortunate. You get 0 times infinity plus an error of order j to the 0. So this term is okay. We don't care about that. And this one could be okay, but we have to be a little bit more careful. So the infinity comes from the integral diverging at spatial infinity, the integral of the Wessimino term, and that infinity is associated with the breakdown of the effective theory coming from heavy modes, which we've integrated out, becoming light as the BEV falls off. So remember, the UV scale, the way we're defining it, is sort of local. It's the BEV of a local field, and in the classical solution, that local field falls off to 0 at infinity because it has a dipole source. So the effective theory breaks down at infinity, but that's fine because we're in a conformal theory. So we have alternatives. In particular, we have alternative conformal frames. So we can go to the conformal frame of the round 4-sphere, where the 2 insertion points have an order 1 angular separation. And in the sphere conformal frame, the only term that contributes more than order j to the 0 is the coupling of the Euler density, E4, to the effective dilaton, negative log phi. Okay, so the effective dilaton, so the reason this is the effective dilaton is because it's the leading operator in the effective theory that spontaneously breaks the conformal symmetry. And so it's it couples in the Wessimino term to the Euler density, and we know what that is on the sphere, and we know what this is in the classical solution. But in fact, the actual details of the classical solution are unimportant at this order. The details only contribute at order j to the 0. It's only the overall j scaling of the classical solution that matters. And the overall j scaling is almost uniformly j to the 1/2. The only place the j scaling is not quite uniform is near the insertion points. But we can regularize and renormalize that singularity in a way respecting the symmetries of the system, but you don't even have to do that at this order because it's actually convergent at the insertion points. So there's really no funniness with short distance contributions of the insertion points. We really do just get a calculable constant times log j from the Wessimino term. So this normalization is convention dependent because this E sub 4 is convention dependent, but the result is not. So I'll express the value of alpha in a convention independent way. So the value of alpha contributed by the Wessimino term is the difference between the A coefficient of the underlying CFT and the effective theory on moduli space in the numerator, and the denominator is 12 times the A coefficient of a free massless hypermultiplet. So we just put that in the denominator to give a convention independent normalization for alpha, because the normalization of A is also convention dependent. And again, we don't need the form of the classical solution at all, even though it's not that complicated. But yes, you need it if you want to calculate the order j to the 0 term, but we don't. We just want the log. So now we'd like to check our predictions. So there are many n equals 2 superconformal theories of rank 1, and when I say many, I mean at least I mean at least 18. Doesn't matter. Actually, if you roll up the screen, I can explain, say what these are. There are 18 theories of rank 1, but I only need to tell you the ones I remember anyway. because there are only two cases in which the two-point functions have actually been worked out. So in the cases that have actually been worked out, so the simplest case, of course, as usual, is n equals 4 superconformal Yang-Mills with gauge group SU2. It's fine. So n equals 4 with gauge group SU2. So in this theory, the two-point functions y sub n have been calculated exactly, and they're equal to the following. They are equal to m tau to the negative n times 2n plus 1 factorial. Which is equal to curly n sub o over 2 pi to the jth power times j to the alpha times curly y tilde sub n times j factorial, where j is equal to 2, the dimension of the generator of the chiral ring of the vector multiplet moduli space, with alpha equals plus 1, and curly y tilde actually just terminates. It's just 2 plus 1 over 2n. So as we said, it approaches a constant as n goes to infinity. Okay. So the large J expansion, as computed from the effective theory, does, in fact, encode to the desired order of accuracy, the asymptotic expansion of the two-point functions of the chiral ring of the superconformal theory, quote-unquote, at the origin. Okay. So this is really, you might say that this is a background-independent test of our understanding of superconformal field theories. So usually, we talk about the we think in terms of superselection sectors. We talk about the moduli space theory and the theory with unbroken superconformal symmetry as being different superselection sectors. We don't really think of them as being the same theory. I mean, we sort of do, but the sense in which they are is sort of unclear. They live in different Hilbert spaces, blah, blah, blah. This makes precise the sense in which the effective theory on moduli space and the underlying CFT are the same theory. So one way of saying it is that you can use these insertions to create an arbitrarily large bubble in which the superconformal symmetry is spontaneously broken by something that's almost a VEV, but not quite a VEV. It's a coherent BPS state, and the physics inside that BPS bubble is that of the effective theory on moduli space. So okay, so this is a test of that. I should mention one thing which we thought was kind of interesting, that the condition of being a coherent BPS state is a nonlinear condition. So in particular, we can only use the effective theory because we have a sort of very complicated superposition of BPS states of definite dimension and R charge. So there is some vague sense in which the nonlinearity of the state is the condition for the use of an effective theory on moduli space, which holographically would describe pulling out a single D-brain from the stack of the strongly coupled gauge theory into the bulk of ADS. So it's a sort of toy model of the Papadudimus-Raju solution, proposed solution to the question of background dependence. It's a BPS state, so it doesn't address the firewall problem. Not that firewalls are a problem. And then let me talk about the second example where some results are known. So unfortunately, despite all of the great progress in exact calculable quantities in n equals 2 theories, this is still the only example where we have anything resembling a closed form for the answer, or where anyone has a closed form for the answer. So for n equals 2 conformal super QCD with gauge group SU2, so number of flavors equals 2 times the number of colors equals 4. So this is another theory with a marginal coupling. So the S4 partition function is known but complicated. So I'll put a check mark and a question mark. But it has a closed form in terms of the Barnes double gamma function. But that was too complicated to use, so we just used the perturbative approximation to it. Okay. So what was striking, let me see if I can get my plots to work, because I think they're pretty striking. Okay, good. So the first plot, which I'll show here, view full screen. So this plot shows, so here's a certain sum rule, a combination of three adjacent two-point functions calculated using exact supersymmetric methods, starting from an approximate sphere partition function. Yes, thank you. So we have essentially independent. Very quickly, the results become independent of the gauge coupling. So they start out a bit different, but they converge almost immediately to zero, which is a matches the prediction of the effective theory. So if you multiply by n, the effective theory predicts convergence to 2, the dimension of the generator of moduli space, and of course it does converge very, very quickly. And you can only see any dependence on the microscopic gauge coupling at the level of the sub-leading correction, which depends weakly on the value of the gauge coupling. Our theory predicts it converges to minus 4, and this is a sub-leading correction in the log. So our theory is very accurate. And then the next order of approximation is j to the 0. So in the remaining 2 minutes, I will tell you what I know about the relationship to resurgence. Well, it won't take 2 minutes because not much. But we do think that we can tell you a couple of interesting things. The first is that these amplitudes can be expressed more conveniently in terms of the full coherent BPS states, which are represented as the local operator that implements a boundary condition that the fields are on a point on moduli space. So when inserted at infinity, the coherent BPS state just gives a boundary condition that the fields go to a non-zero constant. Okay. So the two-point functions of those operators have remarkable resurgence properties, or rather, they don't need resurgence at all. They're actually convergent. Observables in those states aren't always convergent, and they have interesting and calculable asymptotic expansions at large j. And We think there really exists a correct answer in resurgence theory to the question of why is the large J expansion so preternaturally accurate, not just in superconformal theories, but in all theories where it's been tested. So I think I'll end there and take your questions. Thank you.
Please, questions. We still have time. Yes, please.
So there's been this proven result. I'm pretty loud, but there's been this proven result from Simone and Karen Huot that in the large spin expansion, everything's analytic, which is kind of surprising and miraculous.
Yes.
Do you think that there's a similar result here? And
there is a similar result here. Okay. So that's what I was referring to. So I can even write. Let me write the basis for it. So, so in any theory where a moduli space actually exists, it must be the case. So not just n equals 2, but even n equals 1, or well, if a bosonic theory existed with this property, it would also have to satisfy this inequality. So this theory must satisfy this, goes as J factorial, where, as I said, J is N delta. So the two-point function of coherent BPS states, so by a coherent BPS state, I really just mean the operator which, if you insert it at infinity, is equivalent to being at a point on the moduli space of vacua. So the two-point function of coherent BPS states, which I guess I'll call C of mu, C of mu bar. So that two-point function goes as sum over n. Let me write this sum over j. Y sub n mu bar to the j. So since we know that y sub n goes as j factorial, we know that this has an infinite radius of convergence. Okay, but this is just sort of the analog of this is the partition function with two coherent state operators inserted. So one-point functions go as the VEV of curly O, for instance, is just d by d mu of of log y, or d by d mu bar, I guess, of log y. This isn't exactly analytic at infinity, but it has known places where all the zeros come from the denominator having, all the poles come from the denominator having a zero, the poles all have residue one, and so forth. So this one-point functions have calculable analytic properties, and they're all controlled by this partition function for coherent states, which is an entire function. So I think there is an exact analog of that story.
Yes, please, Arkady. Like J, does it correspond that, you know, in the slightest distance between the BPS states or whatever? I mean, what is the physical interpretation?
The physical interpretation is that the infrared scale is that large J, I mean, there's no such thing as large distance unless there's another scale. So it's a conformal theory. But there is a second scale set by the charge, the R charge density, essentially. The ultraviolet scale, so one can work in an effective theory where the ultraviolet scale is the R charge density, which controls the masses of the heavy states. And the light fields are the...
Oh, but I was thinking in the form that you have these heavy states, let's say, like charge, they have, say, like Coulomb interaction. But yes. If the distance between them is large, then you can do kind of expand, you know, at large distances just, but if and just checking whether it makes sense.
Well, when the heavy states are, the heavy states I'm talking about aren't the states you've inserted. I mean, the heavy states are the ones I'm talking about that you've integrated out.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, but their masses are set by the VEV itself. And the VEV is dynamically set by the amount of R charge in the insertion. So it is that, right? But there's no real VEV. It's a sort of approximate VEV, but it's defined in some precise way. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you. Yeah. Well, I don't see any other questions, and we're just on time. So we can proceed with the second talk of this session.